Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Welcome. This is the way we do the panto bit, and you will say, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you. It's not just school assemblies that they do that in. It's obviously in colleges as well. Thank you. My name is Nick Linford. I'm actually former editor of FE Week. I handed over to my deputy in January, but you may have picked up this morning, very exciting, a new publication will be launching in about September time, so I'm still very much involved, but this session is still about my first love, and will continue to be my... I'm not allowed to say that, am I? Continue to be my first love, which, of course, is further education. I'm delighted to be chairing this panel, and I'd like to particularly thank Policy Exchange for being given the opportunity to do that. Also delighted to have so many people of you here in this session. It's been a long day, but I think a very, very good day, which is great, and I'm hoping that and I'm sure... with the support of the people up here you'll shortly hear from, that will prove to be the case. Today, of course, is very much intended to be about messages to, we've heard from, but to the political parties running up now into just under a year to the general election, in terms of what should be their promises, if you will, or in their manifesto. And obviously, we are focusing specifically on further education, and it's great. I've read the brief from Policy Exchange, and it's very clear that further education is being described in its broader sense, talking about traditional, if you will, colleges, but also the apprenticeship provision that colleges and, of course, the independent sector deliver. And there's, as we know, a huge amount of reform going on in both of those areas. I was, in fact, at a conference Monday, Tuesday, all about... what ended up being all about the apprenticeship reform, which I'm sure we will be touching on soon. So, as I say, very much focused on what do we and you, and we'll hear shortly from our panellists, believe should be in the policies going forward and hearing more about now. Liam Byrne, unfortunately, is not with us. He is, of course, a shadow minister, and I heard from him at the beginning of the week, and he said in about two or three months, working with Andrew Adonis, he said, they will be publishing more detail on their plans, were they to be in office, for further education. So, in fact, now is still very much a good time to be passing those messages to the parties ahead of them publishing those plans. And we'll hear from, for example, Julian, Associate of Colleges, soon, who thinking about their kind of what do they think should be in the manifesto and doing lobbying very hard at the moment. So great time to be having this and to be talking. One thing I wanted to pick up, and I'm sure we will actually cover, I have to say, and it was in the brief, which is coming across gradually at the moment, and I think the noises will get louder and louder, is actually what perhaps is a blurring of lines increasingly between HE and FE. And we've seen, for example, with the apprenticeship reforms, where technically universities will be just as able as colleges and providers and employers to offer the higher apprenticeships, which is really, arguably, the growth market. Apprenticeships is across parties is a growth area, and higher apprenticeships is the bit that's getting even more funding, while everything apprenticeships broadly stable overall, and then anything that's not an apprenticeship, perhaps the exception of traineeships, is seeing very much austerity and decline. And I'll finish on that note before I introduce the speakers around, I suppose, the degree of the realism about the choices that might have to be made with the cuts that are being taken. So if we are looking for a particular promise that would need investment, if it's going to be realistic and perhaps accepted as a solution to something, do we have an answer to what we wouldn't do in order to pay for that promise? And that's always worth remembering in the current climate, I think. If we are going to do something that will cost money, what we have to sacrifice, where difficult choices are going to have to be made with the use of a limited resource. And that goes for both the 16 to 18 FE bit, or perhaps 14 to 19, as well as the perhaps more traditional adult area within further education. So that's all from me for the moment. I'm now going to hand over. We're going to do it in the running order that is on the sheet there. I'm delighted to introduce Jim Knight, Lord, who is with us, who is now a full-time employee with the TS, well, the TS, and also, obviously, on the a spokesperson for... no, that's not right anymore.
No longer.
Okay, all right. Just Lord Knight. Well, even better, you will speak your mind, which
correct.
I'm sure you did anyway. So without further ado, over to you.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, so I've had a couple of months when I've been free from front bench responsibilities after 9 years. So
And mostly what I think about is teaching the school sector. So this has been a good opportunity for me to think a little bit about skills and FE once again. And the starting point in thinking about this question for today is obviously, you know, when you're writing policies for a manifesto for an election next year, it is how can we solve the problems as people perceive them now, but also how can we anticipate the problems that there might be in 2020 so that we can then go on and win that election, having enacted the policies in this manifesto. And in then future gazing, you have to look be outside of education, first of all, and look at what the external challenge is. And there is obviously going to be a lot of rapid change, principally due to globalisation and technological change, with jobs moving globally east and south, with technology replacing the jobs of brain as well as brawn, with that hollowing out of the labour market and those middle-level skills starting to disappear, with limitless information at the palm of our hands, meaning that an education system at any stage that is about cramming people full of fact that they can then regurgitate in tests becomes increasingly irrelevant. It becomes much more important to have an education system in the current and future economy that is about creating knowledge and applying that knowledge, not about the knowledge retention in itself. And so in that context, I very much welcome a move towards a 14 to 19 technical baccalaureate that my party is advocating, that Ed advocated some conferences ago. I would want to be more radical than that, I guess. I would agree with Ken Baker, I'd agree with Estelle Morris and some of my other colleagues in the House of Lords that we should end the national curriculum at 14. And with that, you would then have a limited number of public examinations at 14 and get rid of GCSEs at 16. That then frees up the 14 to 19 phase. And, you know, I was the minister who introduced the raising of the participation age, so, you know, I think I understand that 16 and exams at 16 is an increasingly an anachronism. Now, that is then a fantastic opportunity for FE colleges to move more aggressively into 14 to 19, and essentially then having two sorts of institutions broadly for 14 to 19-year-olds. One that is coaching learners more around knowledge creation than knowledge application, but it's still a blend, and the other blending more towards the application of knowledge as institutes of technical education, as Chris Husbands in his report to the Labour Party describes them. Now, this, I don't think, should be anticipating the granular future skills needs of the economy as we might predict them, because we know we'll get that prediction wrong. What you need is a learning style that is about making things and doing stuff, and building confidence in how you evolve new skills all the time to keep up with the changing needs of the economy, and as obviously technical change drives differing skills demands. There's then two other, I think, really important opportunities for the FE and skills debate. One, you know, if you accept moving away from content regurgitation to coaching learning as fitting better with the needs of both employers and HE, what you're doing then throughout that, particularly that latter stage of compulsory education, is replicating a learning style that works well in university. That means that that first year of a bachelor's is no longer as relevant as it is, because mostly what happens in a first year of a bachelor's is you learn a new learning style. What you've been taught to do is to pass exams, and now you need to learn to be more self-directed, you need to be more research-based, more collaborative in your learning. If we've managed to pull that off in the 14 to 19 phase, then you will be better at online learning. Successful online learning needs quite a lot of self-direction, it needs collaboration in order for it to be successful. That creates much more flexible opportunities around learning. And in terms of lifelong learners and people being wanting to be able to pursue their learning ambitions as we need them to be, through their learning lives, they can then start to use their FE college for accessing more higher education. So the relationship between a campus and FE and online is something that we can start to innovate with, I think, much more creatively. And finally, I think we can, well, not finally, penultimately, we can be more, we do need more serious apprenticeships, more that are longer and carry on and go higher in terms of the level of learning. You know, obviously a presumption to level three, but I think going on beyond that and segueing better into foundation degrees, normally delivered by FE colleges, and smoothing university pathways into the professions. Recently, for Unison, I gave out an award for the best teaching assistant in Dorset, as nominated by learners. I found a teaching assistant that I was, well, I found myself in Bournemouth giving out a prize to someone who was an apprentice teaching assistant. Yeah, as far as learners was concerned, this 19-year-old woman was the best. She clearly was doing a fantastic job. Her ambition, having not really known what to do, having when she finished school, was to become a fully qualified teacher. She faces a six-year period in order to do the OU undergraduate degree and then become a fully qualified teacher. That's a huge level of demand to place on an individual. And we need to make those pathways a lot smoother and a lot easier for people to enter the professions. And the final thing I'd say is on skills, yeah, I am a fan of breaking up some of the problems that we have around the accredited qualifications and how difficult they find it to keep up with the evolving skills needs of the economy. And we do need to start to think better about employer-awarded badging or certification of skills and how we can aggregate those into and certificate those into more agile skills qualifications that in turn might be recognised by universities, but that needs a qualification regulation environment that moves away from guided learning hours, which I think blights agility and alacrity in the skills world, and moves more to being able to assess what you know, not how long it took you to know it, what you can do, not how long it took you to learn how to do it. That would allow us to move the skills agenda on hugely, and that's about as much as I have time to say. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you. Thanks, Jim. So a very, very impressive whistle-stop tour there from 14 to 19 and colleges, and we'll hear about colleges in a moment, right through the way through to apprenticeships and institutes of education, which might be something that you wanted to pick up on, Julian, and also technology, and then there on the qualification side. So real, just gave you a bit of a feel there, almost by not taking a breath to get through all that, quite how much is going on in this space at the moment. So without any further ado, I'm delighted to introduce you Julian Gravatt, who I've known for good on 10 years now. In fact, I basically took on the job at Lewisham College after he left as a curriculum planner there, stayed in touch ever since. He is, of course, the Assistant Chief Executive at the Association of Colleges. Without further ado, Julian.
Well, that was a very accomplished presentation from Jim, and I'm a bit of a backroom boy, so if I don't quite match that, that doesn't mean that I'm rambling on. The second thing is, just because I don't cover the same issues as Jim doesn't mean I don't necessarily think that they're worth thinking through or considering. So we've got an election in 11 months. We've got an economic recovery, but it doesn't feel very secure. We've got a world order that doesn't feel very stable. And we may find that the acronyms RUK and EEA are really important in the next couple of years because of constitutional issues. So education is going to fight a bit to get its place in kind of public policy. So I think it's worth, in terms of working through what we want for further education and skills in from political parties, is got to be quite focused and quite limited, because we've blighted at the moment by ministers who take too many decisions about what goes on in the system. We've got a highly centralised system in which everything is decided at the highest level. Actually, Jim, I don't think when he was a minister was particularly kind of guilty of that. But, you know, it's a... So, in a way, I almost don't want to give suggestions for manifesto promises, because they might get written down and then they'll become something that will be done and sort of ticked off, and actually they haven't been properly thought through. We at AOC are going through a process of thinking through what we want in a manifesto, asking colleges across the country, principals, leaders and whatever. And so, again, if you have views or suggestions, suggest them to me here or afterwards. So, what do I want? Three suggestions. Number one, I think we need honesty about the DfE and the education budget and the biz budget, because we have black holes in both the DfE budget and the biz budget. We have more secondary pupils who are the most expensive part of the education budget. We have all parties agreeing we should have early years expansion. We have a teacher's pension scheme we can't really afford. We have a Harry Potter model of higher education. We have employers who think that training is what government funds, and they're all bidding for more money at the point when the Treasury has got a flat cash. And so the real risk is that people build up promises, and what happens is that we become a bit like a restaurant where, I don't know if it's quite the right analogy, where in order to serve the new customers, they keep taking away the menu from existing customers. And I mean, I have to tell you that colleges are facing some really serious financial problems at the moment in terms of funding problems. I mean, they're managing them financially because what they do is that they deal with reduced funding by cutting expenditure. But, you know, that there are consequences of asking for more things at the same time as not dealing with how we're going to fund them. So honesty about the budget is number one. I think we need, I guess, a kind of education Nicholson challenge. We need to actually be honest about working out how much money is needed. David Nicholson said £20 billion of savings was needed in the NHS and set that out as a promise. There have been consequences and problems with that, but if we don't do that, then decisions will be made on an ad hoc basis. Second one we need to do is to break the mould in higher education. My Harry Potter point is about the fact that we have a sort of notion about higher education that's kind of residential, full-time, three-year degrees. The facts are that, you know, 2% of the age group go to Oxbridge, about another 8% go to Russell Group universities. Of 18, 19-year-olds, it's about 40% of the cohort. That may leave 60%. You know, Ed Miliband talked about the forgotten 50%. It's actually the 60% who don't go on to higher education. And we have to sort of work through whether we've got the higher education system we want. And this is important for further education because we supply people up, but also there are alternative models around. Because, again, it's really important that we educate the elite properly, because we've got to compete abroad, and it's really important if you think, you know, if you, when you watch the X Factor, you want to watch the people on the stage rather than all the people in the queue. But actually, we're a democracy. We want everybody to get the skills and education they want, and there are only so many jobs at that higher level. And there's a report this week by IPPR and Edge which talks about the fact that effectively it's, you know, there's 40% of the jobs are at higher skills, 20% at medium skills, and 40% of the new jobs at lower skills. And in a way, we need to think through what alternative models we want. ASC is producing a paper on this, which my colleagues have written, but it's very good. And it won't say anything new, because what it says is what's been said by IPPR, Policy Exchange, CBI, TUC, and the OECD, that we need a higher education model that is employment focused, closer to home, part-time, shorter cycle, and it's really important. It's not about running HNDs in business and chip shops in kind of above London. It's not about more English literature graduates, where English literature is great if you want to be on Twitter, but it's about kind of construction managers, it's about care managers, it's about energy professionals, it's about higher education in places like Peterborough, Blackburn and Truro. It's thinking through kind of different sorts of models. I mean, Andy's kind of more of an expert on that than me. But okay, that's number two. Number three is we need something done on the kind of careers advice and the transitions between 14 and 24, because so I've explained to you that there's a different sort of world around, and that the sort of jobs that are needed are, you know, it's difficult to see. But what we have at the moment is a careers advice system which is kind of broken, so that, you know, people at 14, 15 are just getting bad information and advice. And with the money being short, if they get bad advice at 14 and 15, make the wrong choices at 16, they drop out at 17, they come back at 18 or 19, at which point, you know, money's not there. So in a way, we've got to think through those sorts of things. So three things, budget honesty, breaking the mould on higher education, and careers advice and transitions between 14 and 24.
to check you just so we can get an immediate 18 response. I was just checking. I think given that you had three and a third of those was about kind of the HE and in response
well,
to
it's
important one, I think. You make really good points, I felt anyway, really good points about the future and around the technical education side. I think it would be great to go straight to Andy, if that's OK with you. I'm going to get an immediate response, and then we'll hear from David after that, if that's all right. So I'm delighted to introduce to you Andy Westwood, who I probably best know off Twitter, which was referred to. I don't know if you're an English literature graduate. I'm not, but I've kind of got a few followers. I've read his work on when he writes about Effie, and it's superb, and I would really encourage you to read both AOC's work, and I suspect Jim's as well, and Patrick and everyone's, but it is actually really very good, and do follow him if you don't. So without further ado, Andy, perhaps a direct response to the HE challenge. Hogwarts and...
Hogwarts. Yeah, I'm from Hogwarts.
No,
I'm not. Look, thank you. Thank you for that. And I'll can the jokes I was going to make about going last, because I'm not going to do that. But thank you to Policy Exchange for kind of organising this and actually giving this... this session a bit of a run, I think, which is really important. I will talk about HE and that kind of FE and HE sort of overlap in a second, but let me get to it sort of slowly. I think, like everybody else, I've got three sort of points to make, and rather than start in the obvious place that actually FE, you know, no one's going to talk about it that much in their manifestos, they rarely do, there aren't that many votes in it, all that kind of stuff. I thought, actually, what I might do is look at what each of the parties are promising on FE and encourage them to kind of not just give them a bit of profile, but to expand on them a bit. I'll get to the HE one as the last one. First one, though, is Labour. Already today we've heard Tristram talk a little bit this morning about... what Labour intend to do, what they've already said they're going to do in FE, and it's, you know, we've heard a little bit about it in this session already, the Institute for Technical Education, the tech back. In a sense, you know, what they've sort of done is try and pull something out of this incredibly broad and complex thing that is FE. And, you know, I've had various jobs over the last few years, but one of them was having to explain to ministers and officials in government what FE was, and Jim wasn't one of them, I have to say, but which is important given the punchline, which is that kind of, you know, their eyes used to glaze over pretty quickly as I sort of tried to describe, well, on one hand it's adult education, on another hand it's kind of, you know, GCSEs, on another hand it's A-level, blah, 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 blah. And I think kind of where Labour have got to is a way to answer that. And a former boss of both yours, Nick, and... yours, Julian, used to describe FE as everything that happens in education that isn't in schools or universities. Whereas, of course, now you can say that FE is everything that happens, including in schools and in universities. So, if anything, you know, this kind of this breadth has got worse. This mission drift has got worse. And I think FE's real problem in that sense, politically, is that it's not known for anything specifically. It hasn't got the kind of thing that it does brilliantly above all others. And I think that's a real issue, not just for politicians promising to do stuff to it or with it, but it's also a big issue for those of us kind of in the sector or kind of, you know, next to the sector about kind of how we explain what we are. And I think it, you know, it just can't be that FE defines itself as what others don't do or don't do well enough. You know, that's just never going to kind of excite anybody in the way that FE should. So I think that's a really important thing. And it can't equally just be about competition at 14 or 18 or 19. It's always been more than that, and it should continue to be more than that. So I think in that sense, Labour's story about, you know, let's have FE known for specialist technical excellence. Let's have kind of, you know, a focus on something that FE can do that nobody else does is really important. And linking it to place and sector is a real kind of step forward, and so I kind of welcome that and agree with that. I also, and this might surprise you given my background, I also agree with quite a lot of what Michael Gove talked about this morning. And I think if he extended more of what he described as his principles behind education reform to FE, we would be in a really, really interesting place. So to pick up three of his principles: autonomy, accountability and quality of teaching. Well, you know, autonomy is the seriously, I think, the most underdone piece in FE policy over the last 25 years. And if you look at schools, particularly over the last 10 years, where academies and now free schools have got curriculum autonomy, as well as kind of, you know, staff autonomy, you look at HE and its own celebrated autonomy, you'll see that FE is incredibly out of step with that. It's incredibly prescribed from outside, not least in terms of curriculum, but it's incredibly prescribed in just about everything, targets, qualifications, and that needs to change. One of the blogs that I wrote not that long ago was about kind of asking the question, semi-mischievously, what might a free college look like? Because if you did free up institutions to develop their own curriculum with employers, you know, with communities, then I think you might be getting into a place where FE at least looks like the other sectors in education reform. I can kind of go on into the accountability and quality of teaching point. Accountability, yes. The other great thing that needs to happen is a reattaching of FE to place and to sector and to employers, because, you know, what we've done as governments over the last few years is kind of get in the way of that, and we've kind of deconstructed that accountability, and I think we need to kind of restore that. So I agree with Gove on that point. And quality of teaching, I have to say, if it's a problem anywhere, it's also a problem in FE, and that's something that we need to acknowledge and kind of act on. And that's partly about how it's been casualised and kind of deprofessionalised over 20 years, but it's also about the kind of freedom to innovate and to kind of, you know, use the kind of knowledge that that teachers have. The Teach Two idea that's now kind of getting up and running should at least have as much profile as Teach First does in schools. So quality of teaching, yeah, I'd agree with that. And then now, lastly, which is the kind of FEHE point, is where I kind of go completely along with what Vince Cable's just said recently. I think on behalf of the Liberal Democrats, but I'm not sure.
Gone rogue.
We shall see. I hope this makes it into a manifesto. I'm not sure whose, but anyway, it's this call for something. And if you've not seen it, it was a speech he gave at Cambridge about 3 weeks ago. And he talked about it in terms of the future for both FE and HE. And he talked exactly kind of in the terms that Julian's just described, which is, you know, we have this incredibly monolithic HE system. It is built increasingly around the three-year full-time experience, increasingly, and it's become even more homogenous, as Thomas Doherty said today, over the last 4 years, at the expense not just of non-honours degree or part-time or post-grad or anything else. You know, we do more and more of that sort of three-year linear experience where everybody gets their HE before they get anywhere near the labour market. And that's a problem. That's a problem for the sector, and it's a problem for the country. So I think Cable's kind of call to be sort of rather more Crossland and Robbins was really, really interesting. You might argue that it's, you know, a bit rich at the end of a parliament rather than at the beginning, but we'll forgive him for that. I think it's something that we do need more of, and to echo sort of, I think, Tristram's words this morning, this is something we've been talking about for 150 years, let alone the last 50. So, you know, this is a place that we could go in a really interesting way, not just for FE owning its own qualifications, you know, delivering at that level three, level four sort of space. It's not just a future for FE, it's a future for kind of competition in HE and provision in HE, actually, that we could do a lot more about. But those are my sort of three sort of big points, and I thought it might be odd at least to agree with all three parties in what they might say in their election manifestos. But a bit of each, or rather a lot of each, and I think we'd be getting to quite an interesting place for FE. Thank you.
One of the things we haven't really touched on, and it was in the brief, and I thought, Andy, you might, which, of course, is loans. And, of course, the HE crossover there, it's the same student loans company. But actually, I thought it might be worth mentioning loans in the context of the money. We've talked, Julian, we've heard from Julian at quite some length about the honesty of the public subsidy. But then you've got, well, what can you leverage from learners? And actually, loans outside of apprenticeships seem to be doing OK, and there have been some flexibilities there around the progression from access in FE, or access to HE, but delivered in FE and then progression through. But then, of course, you've got employers. And you've got employers who have money, and many of them do invest already. And the government are keen for that third piece in the investment jigsaw or triangle, as seems to be a popular image to muster up in these ways, is really, really important. And apprenticeship reforms, now we hear about mandatory cash contributions. But, of course, as part of apprenticeship reforms, that employer-led and very much putting the curriculum reform and the ownership, if it's not employer-led, then certainly greater ownership for employers. So I mentioned many of those things in part because, of course, we're now going to hear from a very large employer, BSkyB, David Wheeldon, who is their Director of Policy and Public Affairs, who we're going to hear from now.
It's always slightly trepidatious coming from the corporate world into a world of educationalists, wondering whether or not I get a good reception or my level of knowledge will be sufficient to engage you. Actually, I'll let you into a little secret. 22 years ago, I started my life as an education policy advisor to a political party. I won't mention which one, but those that are old enough to remember the penny on income tax to pay for schools might get a clue. Those, of course, were the days of the running battles over opting out, when the ideology between the major parties was red in tooth and claw. And I have to say, despite some of the personalities that appear to create differences and conflict these days, I get the sense that the ideology, the thoughts and ideas are far more settled these days. What I want to do is just give you a sense of the context that a large employer has for this debate around skills and education. And just to do that, can I just sketch a little bit about BSkyB so you understand where we're coming from in this? We employ about 24,000 people in the UK in centres right around the country, both our main HQ in London. We have very significant employment in central Scotland, big bases in Leeds and Newcastle and Derby, some of the big red brick university towns we have been investing in very heavily recently. And we have a wide range of requirements as an employer. Our skills base is right across the piece. We have 2,500 people in TV production. We have over 800 software engineers. I think we're one of the largest software engineering employers in the country. We have a field engineering workforce. We have big customer service requirements. We've got sales and marketing. And we've also obviously got accounting and legal, as most big corporates do. So I would say in many ways we are an exemplar of the broad segment of what one has to call the rebalanced economy these days, which is all the political rage. And what we experience in common across all of our needs as an employer is not really some of the things that people get very excited about in education. You know, it's the STEM debate or the STEAM debate. Are we getting enough people with those right core skills? One of what the common theme that we experience as an employer is, in terms of a gap, is the lack of employability skills in young people that we wish to recruit. The ability of school leavers and graduates to apply what they've learnt to a work environment is really seriously lacking, I have to tell you. Business acumen, workplace etiquette, the old grammar issue, self-awareness, all things that as an employer you really, really looking for when you seek young people to come into the organisation. And it's backed up in some of the evidence. The McKinsey report suggested that nearly 60% of all employers say that the youth are not prepared for work adequately. And that is a big indictment, frankly, I think, on what we're experiencing as employers. I'm only giving you our experience, okay? I'm not trying to draw too many broad conclusions from this, and other employers may have a different perspective, and I certainly don't want to cast this as a sort of general criticism of the whole of the education establishment and what we get people coming out of further in higher education and schools. That's not the case, but I am telling you what we personally experience as a business, and we do see a disconnect between the skills that are prioritised by education establishments and the skills required by business. I mean, at Sky, we look at sort of a third work readiness, a third emotional intelligence, and a third IQ for our new recruits. And qualifications then become a filtering mechanism. We don't pay a huge amount of attention to the academic ranking of the institution. In fact, we specifically don't recruit from Russell Group universities. They don't actually supply us with the kind of graduates we want. We're looking for graduates and indeed apprentices who can code software. Well, a lot of the Russell Group universities don't produce graduates like that. They're of no use to us. And so despite employability moving up the agenda in education, we don't think that enough is happening. What's the solution? Well, look, we have to be honest about this. A very significant part of the solution is in our hands. It's in employers' hands. It's not about what you can do. It's about what we can do. And we need to step up. We all need to step up. So I just want to sketch out briefly what we've done at Sky, if I may, because I hope that may help sort of give some ideas about what others can do and how we can interact with the educational establishment. We have this long-term aim to reach out to young people beyond those that we employ. We've been in the game of using our brand to reach out to inspire young people with better life skills for some time. We have two programs in schools, Sky Sports Living for Sport, that puts athlete mentors into over a third of all secondary schools, that inspires young people through the power of sport to engage in education and to learn key life skills. And then we have our skill studios where we bring 8 to 18-year-olds into Sky and we show them how television is made, and then we give them an experience in bespoke studios for them to make their own piece of television. We've got one set of studios in Austerlitz in London. We're building another set in Livingston and plan to open some in the north of England in the next year or so. But what we're now doing is we're still stepping up to join the life skills that we've been concentrating on with the work skills that we also focus on. And that means bringing the school-based and the post-education programmes in under one banner, which we're calling the Sky Academy and launched earlier this year. What we have there is an ultimate goal to provide 1 million opportunities for young people under the age of 25 by 2020. Under the age of 25 actually is the generation that's grown up knowing Sky. We're 25 years old, so it seemed like a good cohort to aim for. And the key work skills legs to the Sky Academy are around building out our apprenticeships and graduate schemes to offer continuous work skills development. So we want to double the places that we've got available. We want to include key transitional skills in our apprentice programmes, including business etiquette and presentation and all those kind of core skills that you need, and focus on the broad range of apprenticeship opportunities, levels 2 to 5, with a guaranteed post-qualification post if those are met. And it's really building scale there that is our key focus. The bit that we're working on and we'll be launching later this year is a new work experience programme for 16 to 18-year-olds. And the aim of that is to really aid this transition from education to employment, which is absolutely critical to us. What we want to do is to bring large numbers of the 16 to 18 age group to come within the business, into Sky, to work with our own mentors, to give them a complete sort of workplace challenge so that they learn what it's like to be in the place of work. And actually, we're going to make technology, Jim, the underpinning of that, because we do believe that right across the business, an understanding of things like coding, really important for us and really important for a whole wide range of the jobs that we have on offer. And then to back that up with post-event support, with access to the content they've created and employability advice afterwards. So if that's what we're doing, what do we want from you, actually? What do we want from everybody in this room? Well, from the politicians, we want them to really focus on providing greater support for collaboration between education and business. And I think that really is about them standing up and saying this is what they want. And when we as business offer opportunities for politicians to say to their local schools, yes, this is something that you should be engaged in. And I do think that the power of the political pulpit in all of this is really very, very important. Secondly, from schools, well, I think there's a role for Ofsted here in ensuring that schools improve guidance and ensure that all students are given experience of the workplace. We have a question as to whether or not work-related learning for under 16 should be something that is focused on more. And we certainly think that schools should be tracking the destination of their students better. And from higher education institutions, we really want you to be more aligned with the needs of the labour market. And some of the things I've heard this morning actually fill me with a huge amount of encouragement there. But few universities, who aren't that well represented here today, as far as I can tell, have a sort of defined employability strategy. Most still define themselves through academic credentials, and employability doesn't really feature within the construct of degree courses. And you know, businesses such as Sky, we're looking for partners. We're looking for partners in FE and HE to work with us to design programs that give our young people coming out of education the best opportunity to find employment. And if we can achieve that, I think we will gear our economy up to do better, but also we will provide much more opportunity for young people, which in the end, I think, is what everybody here is for. Thanks.
Thank you, David. And I think many of the messages many of the sector will have heard and repeated and really powerfully, absolutely, about the employability skills. And it's interesting that particularly the study programmes, if you think the Alison Wolfe recommendations, which have very much been taken wholeheartedly on board in the reforms, this is the first year that work placements are being funded as part of that study programme. But we still to get to the end of the year, and I think in many cases the expectation is the work placement would happen around about now. So there's quite a bit of an analysis over the next 4 to 6 months ahead of the election to see whether that's working or not. And maybe one of the things that the government might have to look at, whoever they are, whichever colour, is not just English and maths, as it will next year, becoming a funding requirement, mandatory, where they haven't had it. But in some programmes, certainly work placements may have to be really pushed through if they're not being taken up in partnership between the employers with the rest of the FE, in this case, the FE sector. So clearly employability, a huge challenge, and again, traineeships new this year, that may be something that you're looking at quite closely, as many employers are already have, and many cases starting to really pick up and do now, along either in partnership or on their own with colleges and training providers. OK, we've got about 10, 15 minutes to hand the floor over to you. I'm told to make it very clear that that you please stand up, say where you're from and use the microphone, because that would help the videoer identify you. Although where you're sitting to take the first question in that corner could be a challenge for the camera, but we'll do our best. If you could make it clear to me that you'd like to ask a question while we do this. So if you could introduce yourself and put your question or comment to the panel.
Hello, my name is Keith Herman. I'm convener of the Careers Alliance. Just to start off with a point, and that is this view that employers have that school leavers are not equipped for the world of work. And just to get some data into that picture, I can understand the concerns raised by Sky with regard to their experience. But the UK Commission for Employment and Skills does a survey of 80,000 employers, and they ask us questions specifically about employability skills to employers who actually recruit school leavers. So not just perception-based views on young people, but those who actually recruit school leavers. And the majority say they're actually quite satisfied with the level of skills and capability that young people have. So my first point is that we really need to get away from the demonization of young people and the demonization of schools. And I think it's really important for employers to be doing that, not just standing on the fence criticizing the system. So my second point is I really welcome what you're doing in this space by actively engaging as an employer with schools in a way that helps young people get ready for the world of work. My third point related to that in the question is that you are doing this as one employer. My question is how do we scale this so that employers work in partnership? Because I work in the careers space part of my work, and there are a multitude of initiatives and schemes and programs that employers are creating. Charitable foundations are running, third sector organisations are running, schools have a statutory responsibility. How do we bring some coherence into the space?
Did you want to pick up the challenge initially there?
That's a very deep challenge. I mean, first of all, I absolutely agree with you about not demonising anybody here. This isn't about fault. I do believe that actually that our education system from when I was working in policy in it 20-odd years ago has moved on incredibly. I don't hear talk about the FE sector being the Cinderella service anymore, which is what it used to be called all the time back then. But certainly from an employer point of view, we're looking for partnership. And so it's partnership with schools, it's partnership with FE colleges, it's partnership with universities is what we really want. And where we do struggle, actually, to be perfectly fair to everybody in this room, it's with universities we struggle the most, I have to tell you. Because there, I think, the sense of preserving the academic rigour and indeed the way they measure themselves against each other is so ingrained that it's quite difficult to break through. But we have extensive partnerships throughout schools and the rest of education. What we can do as an employer is to share our experience, to host events at Sky, which we're doing. We're building what we're calling the Believe in Better building to house our academy. We're going to open it in the autumn. We only thought of it a few months ago, and we're just getting on and building it, which will give a physical presence to all of this. And we're hoping that we can open up our new campus out in Austerlitz to more people so we can bring them in. And I am not trying to pass the burden on to all of you. I think we as employers need to step up, absolutely. And if we can work out a better partnership arrangement, I think this is, this is a nut we can crack. Sure about it.
We're just going to take a question here, then here, and then here. Thank you. Again, if you could stand up and introduce yourself.
Hi, my name's Simone Aspis. I'm a Policy and Campaigns Coordinator for the Alliance for Inclusive Education, which is an organisation that campaigns and promotes inclusive education for disabled learners. It's interesting around further education, because what we're finding increasingly is the number of disabled young people who are all being sent on to segregated, discrete courses, i.e., preparation for employment courses, preparation for independent living. And what we're not finding is the reforms, the advancement of further education, really embracing the inclusivity of disabled students. A lot of them are being included in mainstream schools. And don't I say it, universities are more inclusive. So there's a gap in the further education provision. So what I'd like to do is ask each one of you, what needs to happen so that we can actually start preparing for the Children and Families Act, which says pre-assumption for mainstream education for all disabled young people. What I mean by that is disabled young people accessing mainstream courses. What I'd like to ask David from the Skies Academy is how inclusive is your academy, and what actions are you going to be taking to include disabled young people in your academies, in your academy programmes, in your work placements and your apprenticeships?
Okay. We'll go to David in a moment in terms of your specific case, but I think Julie wants to come in here on, there's a in the college world and yeah. Julie. You first.
Okay. I think it's a really good point. I mean, colleges have made quite a lot of progress in terms of inclusive education in the last 20 years while I've been in the sector, but you're right that there are still gaps and challenges. The new arrangements that you talk about are only just coming in now. The Children's and Families Act's only just been passed. We've had a fairly chaotic new funding model that's come in, which link higher amounts of funding to those people who are identified at the same time as the money that's available for other learners is being cut back. So in a way, I guess that sometimes that the reasons why colleges make decisions about how they educate people can be decided by those sorts of issues and the way in which they suddenly get expected. But I'm more than happy to talk to you afterwards about those issues.
As a large employer challenge, just put to you, what are you doing?
But the really interesting thing is that the representation of disabilities and other groups in society is something that the TV industry has grappled with not very well, if I'm honest with you, over a long period of time. And we sort of talk about it, but we don't do very much. Look, when you build new programs, you've got to put the accessibility at the core. And actually, one of the things that we as a business have always tried to do is to recognise that our customer base represents all segments of society. So accessibility of our services is absolutely key, whether that's hard of hearing or hard of sight. And so we are trying to take those principles into what we build in our work experience and our academy programme. But I'm not going to downplay the difficulties. It is It is hard. And the hardest thing is accessing students from those groups. I mean, it's not just those groups. It's hard to access other demographics, ethnic minorities. It's hard to access poorer socioeconomic groups as well. Because actually what tends to happen is when you make these things available, it's those from backgrounds that are used to accessing these things that come first. And you have to really, really work hard to go out beyond the sort of the natural tendency for it all to go to frankly, the leafy, well-off areas that aren't well represented.
Well, this is clearly something with limited budgets and prioritising, something that the political parties are going to have to be very alert to in the use of the subsidy. We haven't got too much time left, and I've got a question here and a question here, which might be as much time as you have, I'm afraid. So apologies to those of you who haven't had an opportunity yet.
Thanks. I'm Andrew Brewerton. I'm principal at Plymouth College of Art, which is an FE institution transitioning into the HE sector. And we, last September, opened 4 to 16 through school. So we're in the primary, secondary, FE and HE sectors, and I think after this morning's session, we're looking at early years development as well. if you tap an art student on the shoulder and say, what do you do? That you're unlikely to hear, I'm an FE student or I'm an HE student. They'll tell you, I'm a filmmaker or I'm a fashion designer or, you know, I'm a graphic artist or whatever. The kind of vocationalism, the kind of vocational learning that artists, designers undertake is not particularly part of the general skills agenda that is, I think, a kind of narrowing skills agenda that we're facing at the moment. And in our model of employability and the kinds of self-employment, for example, that artists and designers typically undertake in a complex supply chain doesn't fit the apprenticeship model particularly well either. We kind of sit outside of all of these major currents, and yet the value of art education to the creative economy and in terms of business development is, I think, extraordinary and long-standing. I wonder if was struck by Andy's question, really, implied question, which is, instead of defining FE by virtue of what it isn't, it's not school and it's not university, whether we're missing a trick, really, and that there's a particular kind of vocational learning that is extensive. It's more than 14 to 19. It completes at degree level or, if you like, business startup. How it is that the FE sector might position itself differently in those terms.
Okay, thank you. I think we'll take a question here and then we'll use that to conclude and wrap up any closing comments on what you said and anything that we hear now.
Thank you. Joe Dilger, Educational Governance Consultant and ex-head of Governance Oasis Academies. Two quick points, just a general point, not specific at start. Bit of a shame, unlike previous panels, it's not more of a diverse panel, it's an all-male panel. Anyway, made that point. But it'd be good to see some women leaders in further education and beyond showcased. Yes, indeed. And my second point is just in terms of asking the panel to input, as David already has. I'm speaking at a Gloucestershire secondary school to the sixth form on Monday for Inspiring the Future campaign. And one of the things I've got to speak about, even though I've not been on apprenticeship, I went to university, is apprenticeships and higher apprenticeships. So just really any pointers from the panel in terms of maybe schemes through further education that are not that widely known. I think David touched on that point. This is a school in rural Gloucestershire. So maybe just if you just have maybe one example each of something that's not well known in further education or through an employer that I can tell the students at the Gloucestershire sixth form about on Monday, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
Well, that's a challenge that's been laid down. I'm not sure if we've got the time to give you all a classic example, but does anyone want to pick up on apprenticeship specifically?
I'm happy to try and do both. Because I think one of the things that just interested me around what you said from Plymouth, yeah, was this notion of vocationalism. And I think a stronger link between vocationalism and professionalism is a trend that we have to encourage, and is what I sort of hinted on when I talked about the teaching assistant from Bournemouth.
teaching is the biggest profession in the world. There's 80 million of them around the world, and it's arguably the most important profession in the world. And we need to create... I mean, there's too many routes into teaching at the moment, and yet it's really complicated to work it out. If you're in the forces or all those different things. But that route from someone who just starts working as a teaching assistant through to being a professional teacher, and then the professionalism of continuing to upgrade your practice through your teaching career, is something that I think is really interesting, something that we should link more, we should link with the professions in construction when we talk about vocations. And, there's a whole relationship that we need to work out. And that then says, well, one of the apprenticeships that I think is shows huge promise are the teaching assistant apprenticeships, and talk in Gloucestershire about those.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, and Andy.
Yeah, well, let me first apologise for being part of a hideously undiverse panel. It's not as good as it might be. But a couple of points I wanted to make, really, which is partly about the creative industries, I think, and creative education, and partly about the kind of, this inevitable, I think, sort of coming against each other between the education system and the world of work, which was a point I tried to make in my opening remarks, which is that, the more we kind of conceptualise our education system, and I would include FE and HE in this, and I think schools actually bear the consequence of this rather than the cause, is that, the more we organise things around kind of a rising cohort, the more we concentrate on kind of, Julian's Hogwarts model of HE, or the more actually we organise kind of FE as a kind of competitive choice at 14 or 18 or 19 or whatever, the more we lose of that kind of continuing education, that kind of that space where employers and education providers can kind of come together more productively and collaborate, rather than this kind of linear notion of you do your education and then you find out. Because if that's the way you organise things, we're always going to get that kind of sort of blind date between people coming out of it and the kind of what they're going to do or not be able to do in the workplace. I think creative education, actually, and the creative industries is potentially an exception to that, because it is kind of, the nature of employment is slightly different. I think the nature of provision is slightly different. So I think there is kind of, there is something to kind of look at how that's organised and how it sort of meshes in with self-employment, with kind of different work patterns, which may buck that trend, which would be an important thing to take, because, as we know, it's outpacing kind of growth in the rest of the economy in employment terms, in productivity terms, and not doing so well in terms of how it's being prioritised in provision of education. But nonetheless, that there's some stuff to look at there, I think. But we all need to kind of acknowledge that kind of, the more we talk about only the young and particular models, the more of these issues we're going to find ourselves moaning about without kind of getting into the right place.
Okay, thank you, Ellie. Well, listen, we're slightly over, and I'm going to get it to take us a little bit even more slightly over, because there's something I wanted to do right at the end. I'll do the thanking you all so much first before we do it. So thank you all for coming to the session. I hope you found it useful. I'm sorry we don't have even more time. We could be here, I'm sure, a very long time, debating these very important things and sending messages, I hope, to those that have to write the manifestos as much as ultimately implement, possibly implement, parts of, possibly, one of them. The last thing I want to do, I put the panellists on the spot, actually, and to put yourself in the position, if you will, of Matthew Hancock, who has a meeting in the Treasury and has a surprise. They want a gift. Effie, let's make it 200 million. It doesn't matter where it's come from, but it's new money. It's a very simplistic question, because I only want you you've only got permission to use the 200 million for one thing. How best would you use that 200 million on, if very briefly, because of the time, as much as not giving you too long to think about it, because that wouldn't be as much fun. David.
Oh, right, I've got to go first now. Right? I get the graveyard slot when I'm speaking and the difficult one to answer. I would continue with the theme of careers guidance, and I would look at investing substantially in programmes that allow FE and employers to link up more closely.
Okay, careers guidance, you don't have to have anything, could be that, anything you'd like, you've got 200 million.
Free colleges.
Okay, all right, fine.
Not three, free.
Free. Yeah.
It might only be three.
Julian, the black hole, still a black hole, but you've got 200 million.
I think put it back into the general budget. Okay.
Just okay. Give a bit more in every college. Okay.
Or school or university.
Okay. And Jim.
I have to say, into professional development of the teaching workforce in FE.
Okay.
And some programme to incentivise and mandate that.
OK, good. Well, it can only be one of those or maybe none of those. It just goes to show how many things good money should be and probably needs to be spent on. Thank you very much for your time once again, and for a final show of appreciation for our panellists.